Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my two co-pilots. There's Danny King, the writer for The Film Stage.
Hello, co-pilot.
Now, I would be the pilot, and you would be the co-pilot.
Oh, sorry.
Or, like, yes, I would be captain, and you would be first mate.
Yes, Captain Whitaker. Good to be here.
Not Captain Kirk?
This is going to be the first in a long line of things where I wish Captain Whitaker was in the Star Trek movie.
He'd probably be a better captain than Kirk.
The couplings are unaligned. All right, we're going to flip it. We're going to go into a role. All right, anyway, and Nick Newman back after his week-long furlough.
Yeah, this episode is already so far off course, so maybe we should just wrap it up now.
So far off course, maybe we should reach our destination through the stars.
Yes, it's good to be back. I still haven't seen Gatsby. I'm probably going to go today, though.
Oh, okay, that's good, because we were interested to see what your opinion of the film would be.
I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. Did you listen to the last podcast?
Yes, I did. It was very weird. Very strange.
I believe it, yeah.
It was like walking into my own home and finding that I had been kicked out, and Dan Mecca was living there. Which, as you can imagine, would be very strange if you found out Dan Mecca was living in your house.
That would be pretty weird. Oh, hey, Nick. I'm you now.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. But it was good having Dan on here, and we may have him or other people back in the future to try to fill the gaps when one of us can't go see a movie, so that we have a trifecta, as always. But that's neither here nor there. It's a new day, and Nick is back with us, and we are all very happy to have him. And it's great because he's back to talk about Star Trek Into Darkness, which is the movie that came out this week that we will be discussing. Before we do that, we will be talking about our three most anticipated films at the Cannes Film Festival. And yeah, that's about that. So before we get into that, I want to remind you that you can use the chapter selection arrows at the bottom of your screen to skip to whatever parts you want. So again, if you're listening to see if you should go see Star Trek and then somehow you think that you should, and you don't want to go to the spoilers, but you still want to hear what's coming out this week, you can do that. Then you can come back and skip right to the spoilers, and it'll be wonderful. Also, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And don't forget to leave us a comment and a rating on iTunes, because that is important, and don't ask me why, because I don't know. So, now, let us get into our actual podcast discussion proper. Let's begin by talking about our top three most anticipated films debuting at the Cannes Film Festival. And we will do that in the round-robin way that we usually do. Anyone who listened to our top three most anticipated of summer or last year's Cannes podcast will be most familiar with it. So let's start with Danny this time.
Oh, very interesting.
Indeed.
So for my number three, I'll go with a film we mentioned briefly before recording, A Touch of Sin. And the director is Zhang Jia, if that pronunciation works for everyone.
It does, I believe.
All right, cool. This is the director of films like The World and Still Life, which are actually the only two films of his that I've seen. In recent years, he's kind of been going over to documentary. His last two films are I Wish I Knew and Yulu. And perhaps that work in documentary makes A Touch of Sin just on paper sound all the more interesting, because if you just look up reviews, kind of like one of the first pictures you'll see is like a woman wielding a knife kind of with blood all over her face and body. And there's in plot rundowns, there's a lot of kind of like separate storylines and genre elements, which just seems like nothing the director has made before. And I would say, I don't know how you guys have felt, but I would say the response has been pretty split so far.
Mm-hmm.
I've been avoiding all dispatches from Ken because I don't want to be spoiled upon opinions.
I mean, I'm not reading too much, just kind of gauging. But I guess it's not surprising that a movie like this would split people, but that doesn't make it any less interesting. And hopefully the anticipation will kind of get me to catch up with more of his films too in the meantime. So
I'm gonna jump in and I'll just say that I'll go second from here on out, because my number three is actually also A Touch of Sin. I don't what was that sigh for?
No, I'm kidding.
Jesus. All right. I've actually not seen any of the other works of this director. I just chose it because it sounded interesting. It sounded like a view of the world that I don't often get, and that's one of the things that I love most about film. So I was enthralled by the idea of it, and I'm looking forward to being able to see it and to eventually contrasting my opinions on it against the opinions of others. But I really don't have anything to add beyond that. So, yeah, Danny and I both think A Touch of Sin is going to be worth checking out. Nick, what about yourself?
How do I feel about A Touch of Sin? Or how
I mean,
do
yeah,
I
you can do that, and then you can do your third film.
I've never seen a Zhang Jia film, unfortunately. I actually have 24 City, his most recent narrative, here at home, so I'll be watching that soon. The reaction I've heard is mixed, but the way I feel is that canned reactions can never be trusted.
That's kind of a truism.
Yes, every year a film there will get a slightly tepid response, and then it will go on to be one of my favorites of that year. Last year, I think the main signifier of this trend was Cosmopolis, which was pretty lukewarmly received, and then I fell in love with. It's something that happens. I can't explain it. I've always wondered what the source of that is, but in any case, the canned reactions do not necessarily faze me. Going off that, actually, I want to preface this by saying that Inside Llewyn Davis, the Coen Brothers film, is not on my list. Even though I want to see it very, very much, I've heard that it's very, very good. That does not surprise me.
Yes.
And so it has a release date, it has a distributor, so I can sort of, I feel like I can put that aside.
I think I'm actually doing the same thing. It's like in my cast-offs. Like, I really want to see it, but I didn't feel it was worth the top three.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Excellent.
So anyway, moving on, my number three film is going to be Only Lovers Left Alive, the new film by Jim Jarmusch, starring Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton, and John Hurt, Mia Wasikowska. It's a vampire love story centered around the world of rock music, from what I understand. It's okay. If that doesn't sound like one of the greatest films ever made, then we just can't see eye to eye on things.
My concern for you, Nick, is that you will see this and then completely forget that Mia Wasikowska is in it. Because that is a problem you've had in the past.
Oh, that's right.
You're right. You didn't even remember that you didn't remember.
Yeah. We should do a study on what she does to my memory. How she just fades from it.
So I wonder if we can give you like post-hypnotic suggestions if we just hire her to tell you to do stuff.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. So yeah, honestly, I feel as if that description kind of says it all. But there's also the context of it a bit, where he hasn't had a film in 4 years. His last movie was The Limits of Control, which I don't hold in as high a regard as his other work. I think that it is a failure of sorts, but that movie is a fascinating failure that only a great artist can make, I think. And so since he has made that, he can, you know, move forward and hopefully sort of expand a bit. Because to me, The Limits of Control felt a bit too contracting, I think, for him and his stylistic tendencies. Only Lovers Left Alive, don't know much about it. There are two clips online, each are about a minute long, but they don't really show much. Also, curiously, this is his first film that was shot digitally. So I'm wondering what impact that'll have on him.
Yeah.
Because he's usually very... His images are usually very rich and sumptuous. So the switch to digital will be another item of curiosity. But yes, Only Lovers Left Alive is something I'm greatly anticipating.
Excellent. Danny, did you see Limits of Control?
No.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think I just added it to my Netflix queue.
Because I enjoyed that movie quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I was just wondering, because I haven't met a lot of people who've seen it. But yeah, I enjoyed it. And now that you've brought this up, I still think it wouldn't be on my top three, but it does sound interesting. Quite an interesting movie. Yeah. Rock and roll vampires. All right, so Danny, what about your number two?
Yes, number two. Just to briefly add to Nick's earlier point about the Coen Brothers movie, I probably won't mention The Bling Ring here, just for the sake of repetition. So yeah, that's that.
And people that can have been kind of lukewarm, so you should just stop all except...
enough people have loved it to make me, to maintain my excitement. But number two is a movie called Stranger by the Lake, which I believe is playing in one of the sidebar categories. And it's by another director who I might have trouble pronouncing his name. His Alain Giraudy. That's probably terrible. But actually, I've heard a lot about this director over the last few days, and I've never seen anything by him. And I know... I think someone I've mentioned on the show before, Dan Salit, who's directed a few films, on Twitter the other day, he called this director just like one of the best in the world right now. And that was pretty high praise. And the things I've read and heard about this movie are very interesting. Apparently it's kind of a mix of like a crime story with very heavy depictions of gay sex, and it's caused a lot of kind of ruckus on the croisette, if you will. So yeah, I think it sounds like a really interesting project, and hopefully, as with A Touch of Sin, it will I'll try to find some time to catch up with the director's other films.
That sounds like a really terrible Luc Besson film, Ruckus on the Croisette.
Yes, hopefully he's listening.
Get on it.
Well, my two main areas of interest are crime and gay sex. So
we all know that. I mean, go on.
This film has
it all,
attention,
right? Yes. My number two is Shield of Straw by Takashi Miike.
Yes, yes.
It's I read the synopsis for this film, and it basically sounds like SWAT. If anyone saw the Samuel Jackson, Colin Farrell movie.
I saw that in the theater.
Yeah. Oh, you did?
I think I saw that like opening day, actually.
Wow. What did you think of that?
At the time, I thought it was great. But how would I feel half a lifetime later? I don't know.
I was about to say, revisiting it. I remember not digging it that much, even when I was, you know, young and foolish. I did like Jeremy Renner, which is... hilarious because he wasn't really a name back then. And I'm for some reason always a fan of Colin Farrell, so who knows. It also has Dan Rydell from Sports Night in it. I don't remember that actor's
name. Are we just talking about SWAT now? Or?
Yeah, but I was just saying, like, it's so this is the preface for why my reaction to this film kind of surprises me, because I read it and I'm like, that's a SWAT ripoff, right? Like, that's just a ridiculous kind of move on the SWAT thing with a little bit of Ransom thrown in. And then I was like, but wait, it's by Takashi Miike. So at the very least, it's going to be one of the more visually and like energetically interesting films I've seen this year. And then I got really excited because I'm constantly like, I wish I could take these boring, staid, stupid action films and like give them a really good director. And I realized that like this was like someone had reached into my brain and taken that idea and just been like, yeah, this is perfect. So I'm outstandingly 100% just so... thrilled that this film is happening, and I can't wait to be able to see it, because 13 Assassins is also one of my favorite films that I can just go to and like watch and always know that I'm going to be in the mood for it and always enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So does my riff on SWAT now make more sense to you?
Well, to be fair, the plot of that is a very sort of classic Western narrative archetype, I think. So I don't think it's so much ripping off SWAT, which, you know, they do teach that in screenwriting classes, of course.
Oh yeah.
You know, that this is the most anybody has mentioned that film in one conversation since at least 2007, right?
I know, I'm pretty proud of myself, actually.
Yeah.
I know, and I'm not saying it's like it's like when Dread and The Raid came out at the same time. Like, I'm not saying that like there was some spy who was like, all right, we're gonna take this and we're gonna do this and no one's gonna notice. I'm just saying it's interesting when I can look back on a movie that I remember only kind of lukewarm and then see that same idea taken and run with by someone with perhaps a little more talent and imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'll be interesting. I think it'll be very interesting. I also feel like Japan is less of a weaponized society than Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how the attempts on the main target's life are going to be strung out, you know? It's it'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to it. And like I said, I love Takashi Miike. He's an incredible director. So his name alone got my interest, but the plot and all of my personal connections with it sealed the deal. But Nick, what about yourself?
Okay, so for two, this is the most difficult choice, I would say. It was between Claire Denis' The Bastards and Asghar Farhadi's The Past. You know, two movies that I would very much enjoy sitting down to watch. But I'm going to go with The Bastards.
Ooh, yes. Sorry, Farhadi.
Yeah. He's licking his wounds. So it's funny. It's actually a connection of sorts to Jim Jarmusch, because Claire Denis has not had a film play or premiere since Cannes 2009, also when she showed White Material, which is a movie that was actually the first... It was the first title of hers I had seen, and I was not too keen on it. But since then, I've gone back, and I've been going through her filmography and been sort of knocked back by her work, which is really unlike anything that anybody in the world is doing right now, I would say. And so the specter of a new film of hers is obviously quite a, you know, it's a looming prospect. And reading the plot descriptions of it makes it sound like sort of a more, you know, sort of thriller-esque title from her. But the thing is that you could describe pretty much any of her films with a traditional plot synopsis. I mean, Beau Travail is actually an adaptation of Herman Melville's Billy Budd. So if you know that story, you could sort of say, oh, well, it's about this, this, this. But in reality, the actual film itself is nothing like what that would typically suggest. So there is that level of curiosity as to how she'll transform these plot threads into her own work, which is a very when we wrote about our most anticipated Cannes titles, I said it was intoxicatingly tactile, which is to say that her images have a very strong sense of touch to them.
Yes.
The way she uses color and texture to kind of induce a feeling, which is part of the discovery of her work and sort of the way she is implementing this into her stories. It's really incredible. And so I think that The Bastards, I cannot possibly tell you how it will turn out, but I have very high expectations for it. And I think that if all goes well, it'll sort of be one of the talks of the town, even though it's not in competition. It's in certain regard, which is kind of interesting.
All right.
Yeah, it also features Lola Creighton, who was fantastic in...
Oh, nice.
Who was fantastic in... Oh.
Yeah. So it's interesting to see how she's kind of monopolizing French cinema with all these directors.
All right, Danny, what about yourself? What's your number one most anticipated Cannes title?
Oh, wow, quite the setup here.
Quite the fanfare.
Number one for me would be The Immigrant. Yes, very much so. James Gray's film. And what's kind of funny is I would normally introduce James Gray as an underrated filmmaker, but he is completely not underrated in France, where the film's actually premiering. They kind of love him there. He's more underrated here in the U.S., kind of both by critics and audiences, I would say, though he's probably getting to the point where most critics would tell you that he's a really good filmmaker. And this film's interesting because obviously the cast is great. Jeremy Renner, Marion Cotillard, Joaquin Phoenix, who has made several films with Gray. But this is probably James Gray's kind of most ambitious period piece. It'll take him back all the way to the 1920s. I know We Own the Night was set in the late 80s, and I think his other films are present day. So this could be something interesting. Another kind of thing of note is that the film was co-wrote by a guy named Rick Minnello. And if you look up Rick Minnello and Richard Brody, Brody wrote this really interesting piece on Rick Minnello, who actually just passed away. But he was just kind of this really interesting New York cinephile guy who James Gray was really close with, and he was actually close with a lot of other filmmakers in the area. So I'm sure this is like his last credited work or whatever. So that's another kind of angle of interest to the film. And very interested to see how it'll be received on the crow set.
You just love that word, don't you?
Yeah.
I hate that. I hate it when people refer to Cannes as the crow. Please stop. That's all I ask.
All you ask is that no one ever use the word crocette again.
Yeah, I don't think it's much.
I mean, I've never used it before today, so I think I can pretty much give you that. All right, so I was actually thinking about that, because I do enjoy James Gray, but I set it aside. And I just realized that I don't have a single American director, though my choice here does have a North American actor as its main character. I'm choosing Only God Forgives.
Ooh.
Indeed. By Nicholas Winding Refn. And, yeah. I don't know, man. I loved Drive. I love Bronson. So I just, like, I don't know. I've been looking forward to this for a while now. And, yeah, I don't know. Do I really have to explain it to people? Like, I feel like it's a pretty self-evident thing. Another part of it is that this is another one of those movies that the plot synopsis that you see online brings to mind a movie that I also quite enjoyed called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead by Mike Hodges, about a brother trying to avenge his brother's death. So, yeah, I guess all the pieces are in place for this to be the film that I'm most looking forward to. And I do have a couple of other ones that I want to bring up when we're just throwing out some other titles we're interested in at the end. But, hard to get much more anticipated than the follow-up to Drive. Nick, your number one.
Well, tough decision. A lot of good titles had to be sacrificed in favor of it. But my pick is going to be Venus and Fur.
Oh.
Which is the new film by Roman.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I thought about it. It was close, but... Mm-hmm. All right, so what's your justification?
See, this is ultimately my number one, not just because I love Polanski and not just because it co-stars Matthew Amalric, who is one of my favorite actors, but also because this is a movie which was only announced in November or so, and 6 months later it's playing at Cannes. So there's sort of this air of freshness and excitement to it that I don't think that we're getting with all of these titles. Even a few that I picked, like Only Lovers Left Alive, was announced in 2010, for instance. So this one is just sort of coming about now. And it's also... the thing about Polanski is that I think he's at his best when he's working in closed spaces. And this is a film that stars two people. It's set in a single room, and it lasts, from what I understand, in real time for 90 minutes. So the prospect of that, and also the... sort of the narrative functioning of this movie, where it's about a theater director who is auditioning an actress and she comes to sexually and psychologically dominate him. It's such a Polanski narrative trope that all the elements of it sort of congealing really kind of signifies a lot to me, that's worthy of paying attention. So I have no idea how this movie's going to turn out, because I don't know. I've heard nothing about it, really, in terms of just the general reaction or qualitative thing. But as a fan of his last film, Carnage...
I was going to ask, you know, you're talking about you're a fan of him in closed spaces and everything, mm-hmm. what you thought of Carnage.
I mean, I don't think Carnage is one of his... I don't think it's one of his best films, but I did like it very much. And I think that sort of... There's something about Polanski in a small space where it's almost like a trapped animal, where he's kind of... expending every effort to keep the film moving, and the way he's exercising his form there is really thrilling. I thought Carnage was a great formal exercise above all else, really, but even if maybe that movie's script left a little to be desired, I was quite fond of it, if only for that reason. And so to see him kind of continue in that mold, to me, offers a lot of promise. So yeah, Venus and Fur is a movie I am massively anticipating.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm definitely anticipating it, because, you know, after seeing The Ninth Gate and being reminded of what a wonderful filmmaker Roman Polanski is.
Do you really need to bring up The Ninth Gate? Is that necessary?
I still can't believe that that's a film that got made and that Roman Polanski made it.
Oh no, I feel the exact same way about it. I kind of, The Ninth Gate to me is the textbook definition of interesting failure.
Yeah.
Which is actually, that's the thing, is that I feel like Polanski has made very few films that are both not good and not fascinating.
Yeah.
And so I feel like Venus in Fur has the potential to at least fall into that.
All right. Excellent. So that's our top picks for Ken. So here, I'll throw out a couple more. We have The Bling Ring, the new film by Sofia Coppola. Inside Llewyn Davis, which we had already brought up. And Young and Beautiful by Francois Ozon. Those were some other ones that caught my attention and that almost made the list but did not. And then, of course, what Nick had just mentioned, Venus in Fur. Were there any other ones that we wanted to throw out real quick just to stake our claim on their interest to us?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot. I'm going to see Jimmy P. by In Our Displeasure, even though we just posted a C-minus review of it. What are you going to do? Only God Forgives, which is actually another title that I did not put on my list because it's coming out soon.
Right.
Like Inside Llewyn Davis. So, you know. What's weird, Behind the Candelabra, which premieres on...
Wait, didn't we go through this once before? It's Candelabra.
It's Candelabra.
It's a Candelabra.
Motherfucker. Okay. Behind the Candelabra... it's weird. This premieres on HBO in 1 week. Actually, by the time this episode is released, less than a week. Sunday the 26th.
Didn't they do the same thing for Hemingway and Gellhorn?
No, this is playing in competition.
And oh, it is?
What happened was Terry Frimaux, who's sort of the Cannes head honcho, had watched the movie and he loved it so much, I guess he urged Soderbergh to put it in competition to kind of spice things up. So... So I'll definitely see that. I can't wait for like Father Like Son by Hirokazu Koreeda. He's a Japanese filmmaker. Surprise, he's Japanese.
I was about to say, really?
I love his work. I mean, his film Afterlife from 1998 is one of my favorite films of all time. So there's that too. And, you know, Blind Detective by John Ito. That might be fun. We talked about As I Lay Dying, which is
James Franco.
Of Curiosity, at least A Touch of Sin, The Immigrants.
Right.
I mentioned The Past. I mean, yeah, I would like to see pretty much every one of these films.
All right, so you basically just named the entire lineup.
Yeah.
Danny, were there any that you wanted to shine a special spotlight on before we moved on to our review?
Entire lineup.
All right, sweet. So once again, Cannes Film Festival offers an interesting and wonderful mix of films that we all cannot wait to see. So, that being said, and that being finished and completed, let us get into our feature review. This is Star Trek Into Darkness, directed by J.J. Abrams, and starring Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, Zoe Saldana, Carl Urban, Simon Pegg, and Benedict Cumberbatch.
You think your world is safe? It is an illusion. Enjoy these final moments of peace.
By now, all of you have heard what happened in London. The man who did it,
he was one of our top agents.
Your commanders have committed a crime I cannot forgive. None of you are safe.
Clear the road!
Have I got your attention now?
This could just be the beginning.
I request permission to go after him.
Starfleet is not about vendetta, Kirk.
Maybe it should be, sir. Jim, you're not actually going after this guy, are you? I have no idea what I'm supposed to do. I only know what I can do.
Holy shit. You know what I just realized? Benedict Cumberbatch on IMDb is credited as Khan.
Yeah,
That
was a little controversy about a week and a half ago when he started being listed there after people had seen the movie and they went, no, he's Khan.
That's fucking hilarious. Okay, anyway. Let's get into it. So, Star Trek Into Darkness is the follow-up to the very successful and I thought highly entertaining 2009 film Star Trek, which was a reboot / reimagining / sidequel of the original Star Trek TV series and films. It posited a separate timeline to kind of quell the fanboy outrage over some of the changes it made. And yeah, this is the follow-up. There's a terrorist attacking the Earth, and the crew of the Enterprise goes to try to capture him. That is the most basic statement of what the plot is about. It gets a little more complicated than that as motives and identities become more apparent. So let's see if we thought that this movie was worth the trek to the movie theater and the darkness of sitting in a movie theater and seeing stars on a screen. Nick, why don't you start us off? What did you think about Star Trek Into Darkness?
You couldn't hear me sighing.
I could feel it in the static coming from your line.
Yeah, okay, that's what it was. That was me exhaling through my nose. So anyway, Star Trek Into Darkness, the follow-up, as you said, I don't need to repeat what you just said.
No, you don't.
You know, going into this movie, I was actually, I don't know how much I was anticipating it, because I found that the previews were so hilariously morose and portentous. You know, you think your world is safe and et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, come on, give me a break at Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
And part of the reason is because I was a big fan of the Abrams film. Much of that comes from sort of the bright, colorful, fun nature of it, which I felt like they were probably going to be sacrificing in favor of a Dark Knight approach, which in a post-Nolan's Batman world, we should abandon, really. I think that we should be done with it.
I kind of agree, yeah.
Yes. Thankfully, though, I think the movie is not too morose or portentous. I think it actually maintains the fun spirit of the 2009 film. I don't think it's as good. I think it has sort of a lighter sense to it. There is kind of a slightly underwhelming feel to it, kind of a that's it sensation, I suppose, which I think comes from the movie's attempts to be a standalone effort, which I actually ultimately do appreciate. I like that it wasn't too bogged down in the Trek mythology or things of that sort, which I'm not very well versed in, to be honest. I did just sort of enjoy it as a space adventure, a bright, colorful story filled with some, you know, pretty good action. And there was, I think, like the last Star Trek, this movie is actually quite funny, which is surprising because this movie is written by Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman, who are behind the painfully unfunny Transformers series. And by the way, let me just say, even though I did like this film, they are terrible screenwriters.
Oh, they are the fucking worst.
They are terrible screenwriters. And they partnered here with Damon Lindelof, who's an item of curiosity, because he was behind Lost, which for about 5 seasons was a beloved thing, and then the 6th season came about and suddenly everybody turned on him.
Yeah.
And since then he's kind of been just falling down a long flight of stairs with Cowboys and Aliens and Prometheus and maybe now this, because I don't think the screenplay for this film is very strong. What ultimately elevates it is the cast, who have a very good chemistry with one another, who have a very good sense of this material and how you play it, and J.J. Abrams himself, who, though a little too kinetic, quote-unquote, a little too manic with his camera, I think does a very good job of sort of capturing these in-the-moment action beats inside a spaceship, kind of gives it a slightly grounded feel, which I think is actually complemented by the lens flares, which we can talk about if at all necessary. And so, yeah, I mean, I was fond of it, even if there's too much fan service, such as, you know, the villain being Khan, which...
Spoiler alert.
It's not a spoiler.
I told a guy yesterday after the movie, I was explaining my issues with it, and I said the name Khan, and he literally stood up and freaked out.
It's not... That's the thing, though. That's part of...
Well, I was surprised that he didn't know already, but I mean, well, like, if people like him exist...
That's part of the Abrams problem, the mystery box nonsense.
Yeah,
Khan being the villain is not a spoiler. It has no bearing on the plot at all.
But it's played up so much.
Played up, but it's not. It doesn't affect the narrative itself.
That's one of the fucking problems with this movie. Like, it is played up a lot, and it's made a story beat, and it doesn't mean anything to anyone. Like, it doesn't have a meaning.
No, but if you made the character, you know, Gary Mitchell, who's another famous classic Star Trek villain.
Really? Gary Mitchell?
I don't think the movie would be that different, honestly.
No, if he had just kept the character as John Harrison, the movie wouldn't be that different.
Yeah, exactly.
It's literally just a name change, because there is no history behind the character of Khan in this new world.
No, exactly.
They don't explain him at all. It's like, oh, I've been asleep since for a while. And it's just, this is touching on all of my issues, and I can't believe that you're so kind to this movie, because you're usually the guy who will take a thing to task while I'm trying to push temperance. This movie was awful. This movie was awful,
You might as well start reviewing.
Well, are you done your review? Because I was just in a reaction. I mean, it's just, it's bad. It's not a good movie. Like, where do I begin? The main character, Captain James T. Kirk, played by Chris Pine, is the worst possible protagonist in a movie ever. Because he is not only stupid, but he's willfully stupid. He surrounds himself with intelligent people who give him advice. They are literally like three different people whose jobs on this ship are to be his advisor, and he doesn't listen to any of them, which I'm pretty sure is the exact plot of the first film. But it's so impossible to care about his safety or to feel any kind of tension regarding the safety of his crew, because all of these people should realize that he is a maniac who should never be given command of a ship. And it makes Bruce Greenwood's character, Commander Pike, all the more ridiculous, because he seems so certain of how good of a Captain Kirk can be when all we've ever seen is how awful he is. And it's the worst kind of screenwriting. It's the show-don't-tell thing. Like, he's not a worthy protagonist. He's not someone to root for, because he is terrible. And so that's the starting point. From there, you have the nonsense mystery box stuff with John Harrison. You have the ridiculously over-the-top menacing performance by Peter Weller, which is another twist that gets played up that means nothing. The lens
player, I like Peter Weller.
I like Peter Weller, and he does good at what he's doing, but on a story level, his character does not work. And the other problem is, like, there's a character played by Alice Eve, who, like, is her name is Wallace or something like that. That's her last name, obviously. And, like, she's there for two reasons. One of them is to get her tits out. Like, she undresses, and it's literally just like a 5-second insert shot.
There's virtually no reason for that shot to be there.
No, there is no reason for that shot to be there. It's just like, hey guys, we have like two chicks in this movie. One of them should probably get kind of naked, right? Like that was it. It's like, hey, here's some pure old fanboy nonsense. Just like, let's give the audience, we have violence, we don't have any sex, unless you count the two girls with tails at the beginning. But and you were saying the lens flare was like not a bad thing. Her one emotionally resonant scene is destroyed because there's literally a lens flare over her face. She's trying to emote through a lens flare. And any good director would say, hey, this is an emotionally resonant scene. Maybe I should tone that shit down. But they didn't. They didn't care, because the characters and the emotions aren't important. What's important is just the fact that shit gonna get blown up, and we need to get there. Not to mention the fact that, like, all the Star Trek nods are, I guess, fine, but they're not in the narrative of this movie. They're not from the first film. They're from a TV show that aired 50 years ago that I have never seen, and I shouldn't be made to study before going into a movie.
I've never seen the original Star Trek, and I had no trouble following.
Who is Khan? Who is Khan? What is Khan?
He's a guy who was in cryosleep for 300 years. His people were being killed by the humans because the humans are bad. Weren't they?
Because they were in cryosleep. They were like exiled or some shit.
Right, right.
And but so, like then he's woken up. Well, go ahead.
No, and Khan has been awoken to this whole 9/11 Iraq War allegory, which, I mean, the Iraq War was 10 years ago. Can we stop using it as a narrative device, really? Anyway, sorry. It's there, and, you know, he's using him as a terrorist to sort of push forward certain agendas, which I guess is kind of an interesting plot point. If, you know, it's a problem here. The screenwriter, one of the writers of this movie, Roberto Orci, is is a total douchebag.
He's a truther, isn't he?
Which makes him by default a douchebag.
Yeah. he was talking about false flags right after the Boston Marathon bombing.
Yeah, he's a horrible human being, and that impacts my opinion of the movie, that he would put his conspiracy bullshit into a Star Trek movie. That bothers me, honestly, and that bothered me here.
Yeah, it actually bothered me a little bit too, knowing that.
Yeah, that he was inserting this very hateful sort of material into Star Trek, which is supposed to be about the goodness of humanity. That was troublesome.
Yeah.
But it does impact the movie itself. So he's brought back as a part of this initiation of things, which I don't really think is a great method of narrative construction, but it's there. And I think that his presence is unnecessary. It's what I said, it's fan service, but I don't think it's handled horribly. It's just sort of uninteresting.
Okay. Danny, why don't you tell us what you thought? Because you haven't...
About the movie, or
yeah, but like because we haven't
Star
even
Trek
gotten
in the darkness?
We haven't even gotten your basic opinion yet, so maybe you should
jump
in here. Maybe you can level us out.
Yeah, I'm probably in the middle. I didn't really like the film. I definitely had a lot of problems with the writing. I also thought the movie was just trying to do too much at all times. Like I thought right from kind of the opening sequence, I was just not really enjoying the movie. I mean, I really hated that opening where it's like you got the two people running and they have masks on, and then like 30 seconds later they take off the mask and it's like, oh, it's them. And then they're like sprinting through these trees and they're trying to have like a conversation while they're sprinting.
Yeah.
And I couldn't like understand any of it. And then there's this whole thing with Spock coming down and lava's flying everywhere. And then the first two people go back on the ship and then they have to get Spock. And it was just, I was like, I wanted to be kind of eased into this movie. And Abrams was like not letting that happen. He was just kind of trying to throw all this stuff out of you. And none of it really, really kind of just stayed put. And I think Matt Zoller-Seitz actually puts it well in his review, where he's like, there's a joke, an argument, a chase, a spaceship battle, or a brutal close quarters firefight every 5 minutes. And it's like just this assault of different things going on all the time. And I felt like the movie never really settled into a nice rhythm. And I also think in that respect that it never really finds a good tone, because I know Nick was mentioning like the movie isn't as dark as maybe the previews would have you believe it. But I feel like on paper, it's a pretty dark movie, but Abrams just didn't change his approach at all. So it's sort of this weird, I found this weird kind of tension between like how dark the movie was supposed to be and how dark it wasn't because of Abrams just like not really adapting to it or not trying to kind of alter his aesthetic, because it was weird to me, like watching this incredibly bright and colorful movie while, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch is giving these very kind of these speeches of like world destruction and things like that. And yeah.
No, you bring up an excellent point, because it there is no modulation in tone, and like, and especially with the freneticism of it, because there are so many conversations that happen at the most inopportune times, and you know it's only because the screenwriter's like, well, we can't just have these people speaking to one another, like we have to have them doing it in a shuttlecraft while we're flying onto the Klingon planet, like it's like the worst possible time, but we'll throw some jokes in there about how it's not a good time and that'll like ease over things. And then like all these like earth-shattering emotional revelations are made, and then no one ever talks about it again. And it's not fair to the characters, and it doesn't add anything to the film because it doesn't have an impact, and it's just bad. It's not good. I'm shorting out. Someone else say something.
I do think that the script is surprisingly confusing, which I wouldn't expect to say about a Star Trek movie, yeah. I guess. But I think that more comes from muddled plotting. And also, I found the dialogue in this movie kind of difficult to hear.
Yeah, it was.
Which is strange because the theater I saw it in was, you know, well... The sound was, you know, well calibrated, I guess. But maybe it's just a problem with the mix in the movie. But there's a lot of dialogue that's overlapping with Michael Giacchino's score, which I didn't really like that much here, by the way.
I kind of liked the score.
It felt very... There was about three themes in the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's... Dun, 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 and then there's sort of the slightly sad tone. There's that too. And there's really just not... There's not much musical variety here. It very much feels like they kind of recycled the score from 2009. Anyhow, the dialogue, yeah, was a little difficult to pick up on, because I think the score and the sound effects were kind of drowning it in a way.
Yeah.
And so the narrative became a little difficult to follow, which I wasn't expecting. But
especially
I think also,
in that first scene. When they're running through the red and white forest.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I was like, wait, do they need the thing they stole? Like, what is happening? Like, why is Spock in a volcano? Oh, they're about to be in a volcano.
Yeah. The thing is, though, in a way, that kind of... maybe help the film a bit, because I could sort of distract from Orsi Kurtzman and Lindelof and focus on Abrams's, you know, visual style. What's funny about J.J. Abrams? What?
It's like saying that you're talking to a really dumb girl, so you're happy you have a perforated eardrum because she's still pretty.
Well, yeah.
That's a terrible thing, Nick. That's not
it's like
good.
A perfect analogy.
That is perfect. It's funny because J.J. Abrams, I think, is one of the most skilled filmmakers who has never had a voice of his own. He's made, this is his, fourth movie. And I still don't really know who he is as a filmmaker.
Lens flare.
That's the thing, is that his biggest touch is the lens flare, which I do like, but that's one thing. You have to have a bit more than just the lens flare.
Yeah.
And, I think that here, again, what I said, I think that he really abuses the zooms on his camera in really weird ways. There are zooms going on that should just not be in the frame. It actually reminded me of The Color of Money. Has anybody seen The Color of Money?
Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
It's a Scorsese movie from, like, 1985 or something. That's probably the only movie of his I can think of that's actually over-directed, where it feels as if he's really not just interested in the screenplay at all, so he's going to throw everything he can at the frame to try and make it interesting. It's kind of how this movie felt to me, where there's just the camera is just moving too much when he should just be sitting still and just sort of letting a scene play out. I'm not asking for, you know, a Michael Haneke approach here. We're talking about Star Trek.
I think you would be within your right to ask for that.
maybe. But still, I did think that he was doing that a bit too much zooming and panning and loop, 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 and
wow,
that's my technical term.
I was about to say, I've seen you write that out in a few reviews. I'm glad I know how to pronounce it now.
Yes, it's like chiaroscuro. It's like the same. Anyway, but no, I mean he has a good sense of how to make this feel sort of grounded, and I guess I don't want to say humanistic, that because it's Star Trek, so most of the people are not humans, but he does give the action a sense of danger, I think, which is exciting. And one of the things I'm looking forward to in his Star Wars film, I'm curious to see how he'll bring that to sort of a very visually rigid franchise, something that has always kind of followed the same template.
I'm actually excited. After seeing this film, I'm excited for him to do a Star Wars film. Because honestly, like, these films, maybe I know the Star Wars mythology a bit better than I know the Star Trek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't feel like I'm going to be as lost if he doesn't, like, give me some actual explanation.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like the Star Wars films always had more of a jaunty adventure tone.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, the Star Trek I've seen has usually been fairly meditative, speculative fiction.
Yeah.
And I feel like his presence, and I guess the screenwriters as well, obviously sapped a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to him doing Star Wars.
Yeah.
But good good God, I can't. This movie was not good.
Well, I'm sorry you were hurt by it.
It's I was. Like, people at the end of this film clapped.
I saw this in a mostly empty theater.
Good for you. No, yeah, I saw this in a full theater, and I could hear the people reacting. I swear to Christ, there were people crying at some point.
Oh, no.
And then at the end, there was, like, applause. And I felt like I had, like, the world had dropped out from under my feet. I was like, am I the only sane man in an insane world, or have I finally bridged, like, gone over the edge, and I am now the madman?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was... And I don't expect people to stand up and boo. I didn't want people to walk out. But, like, this is one of those movies...
Yeah, this isn't Sam.
But this is one of those movies I keep expecting, like the lights come up and the things start and people just stand up and walk away. Like, the, you know, movies like that? Like, probably Oblivion?
Yeah.
Like, no one clapped at the end of Oblivion. No one was upset. But they stood up, they left, and then they went and got some McDonald's. And, like, when people asked them what they did over the weekend, they'd say nothing. Right. Oh, wait, no, I saw Oblivion. Like, that's what I expected... from this movie, but people were thrilled, and I was angry about that.
Just to go to a point we touched on with Peter Weller, I feel like this is seeing this develop was especially strange after kind of the double villain approach of Iron Man 3.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of bizarre to me that like they clearly expended a lot of effort on this Benedict Cumberbatch character that I was just kind of thrown off when a second villain comes into play. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure that was necessary or even satisfying, especially just, I mean, Peter Weller, like he turns so quickly into this like murdering jerk. Like I was a little upset with him. Like he's kind of like fighting with his daughter and like, I don't know. I was just a little bit kind of, yeah, not interesting to watch. And I was just like, just stick with the one villain. I mean, Cumberbatch is like really good in the role. I think you've got it covered.
Let's use this as a jumping point to go into spoilers.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
There are still twists we haven't talked about. And we've kind of been vague enough that people can't be too pissed off at us. So yeah, spoiler alert for Star Trek Into Darkness. Here's the final question before we really go into spoilers. Should people go see this movie? If a friend asked, would you tell them to see it?
It depends what they're looking for.
Okay.
I feel like you have certain expectations for this movie, and I imagine this would fulfill them fairly well. So if someone asks, you know, if they ask me, oh, what movies are out that I should go see? I might say, oh, see Frances Ha, for instance. But okay. If they ask, should I go see Star Trek? I'd say, yeah, sure.
Danny, what about yourself?
I mean, yeah, I know, like, the two people I saw it with both really liked it.
I went and saw this with two people, and they loved it, but they're Star Trek people.
Yeah, I know one of my friends, he asked me right after, like, when I was like, yeah, I didn't really like it. He was like, yeah, I'm assuming you haven't seen, like, The Wrath of Khan, right? And I was like, no, I actually have. And he's like,
The Wrath
oh,
of
okay.
Khan, which I watched after this film, and is actually a much better film.
Yeah, I'm like... Yeah, so you're justifying my not liking it by comparing it to a kind of more satisfying movie. I don't know about that, but yeah, I don't know. I bet most audience would like the film, but I didn't think it was good.
Okay, yeah, I didn't think it was good, and I've actually told people not to see it, so that's my opinion. But let's get into spoilers. So,
have you been standing outside the theater, like turning people away,
physically restraining them?
Yeah,
don't go in there. There was actually a queue. There was a line of people already outside the theater waiting for the turnaround. And I was just like, oh, God, I was so upset. I was really upset. Anyway. Oh, Jesus. Okay, so spoilers. We'll just whip through this because I think a lot of the problems happen towards the end of the film. There's Peter Weller's character's, you know, just completely predictable turn into a fucking psychotic madman who's willing to destroy an entire ship full of innocent Starfleet people. For what reason?
Because he wants that's pretty clearly explained. He wants the genetic superhumans and they're not going to give them over.
Right. But why does he want... He was going to launch them into a planet to explode.
No, I don't think that was really what was happening. I think he was aware of Kirk's sort of... I think he's very aware of Kirk.
right.
as a character. And I think that that was sort of a setup where he was kind of taking that bet that he wasn't going to do that, that he was going to go down and kind of try to take care of business. I mean, yeah, I will agree that it is a shady plot development, but as far as this movie goes, like, it's actually fairly solid.
But here's my biggest problem, though, is that for a good chunk of this movie, I was actually totally on Khan's side. Like, when he explains things, and he's like, you know, I have 72 crew members up there, and, like, you know, I would do anything for my crew, and then, you know, he's helping out everyone, and I'm like, oh, like, this is interesting. Like, there's this guy who's evil, but, like, his evil aligns with the morality of the Starship Enterprise, because down at the basic level, it's still all about, you know, your crew. And I thought that that was an interesting juxtaposition. And I was like, man, it's going to suck when these two have to, like, realize that as much as they have in common, they're still going about things in different ways. And then it's just all done to pieces because Scotty can't hold a gun on a guy. And Benedict Cumberbatch just, like, becomes completely homicidal, crushes a man's skull with his bare hands, breaks Alice Eve's leg, and then just stuff happens.
I like seeing Cumberbatch.
I liked him in this movie.
I thought he was, it was a little one note just because the sort of, I don't know. I think it comes down to the screenplay, which is not giving him a lot to do, but he's good. Unfortunately though, yeah, he does kind of, it's interesting how there is that turn to the homicidal side where he crushes Peter Weller's skull and he breaks Alice Eve's leg. And it's a good kind of step forward, but then that sort of, I don't know, it doesn't feel like there's much else past that. Like, he goes back to Earth, and I was thinking to myself, I don't know why. Why not just leave?
Yeah.
Why not just go back to Kronos or something?
Yeah, what was the plan? What was his plan at that point? Like, okay, my ship is crippled, I don't have, so I'm just going to dive bomb into Earth, and then I'll run around San Francisco, and hopefully people won't find me.
Well, yeah, also, I find it hard to believe, just sort of, speaking realistically, or as realistically as you can approach this movie, that I don't think he'd be able to destroy Earth with, like, his frozen people and... Oh, no, because they're blown up, too. That's the thing.
Right.
They're gone. So it's
Well, just, no, they're not. That's the crazy thing. The frozen people are still alive.
Oh, right. Which doesn't make any sense. And I guess they don't not destroyed by missiles or something.
But here's the other thing. So I don't understand his point for crashing into the Earth, but also, like, that's one of those scenes where they're like, wouldn't it it's just going to be awesome to see all this destruction, but, like, millions of people must have died.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is a catastrophe. That's like if someone drove a starship into Manhattan and just plowed through, like, all of Manhattan. Like, that is carnage on a scale that we've never seen before. And people are just kind of fine with it. Like, the Starship Enterprise is like, oh no, like, 8 square blocks of future San Francisco are gone. Who gives a shit? Let's get that guy. Like, there's no, like, oh my god. No one is shocked. No one is awed. No one is terrified. You get, like, 16 screaming extras that are running down these future streets. But, I mean, like, when they're doing a foot chase, like, people are still at cafes. There's still cars driving normally. Like, there's no sense of the destruction that just happened. It's ridiculous. It saps any tension from that scene. It just becomes a stupid, computer-generated spectacle.
Yeah.
No, the third act is quite a problem. Yeah.
To go back to an earlier point that could also be considered a spoiler, I really didn't like what they did with Bruce Greenwood.
Yeah.
I was like... okay, so you give him a long scene where he chews out Kirk, then the next scene he forgives him, and then he's like dead.
Yeah, and then he's dead.
And I'm like, first of all, just on like on a general level, like, Bruce Greenwood is probably like the best actor in the movie. it would be like killing Gary Oldman like a half hour into The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
I don't think you can. That's a good character to, like, kill off if you're trying to, like, give the movie a kind of sense of, like, grandeur or whatever.
Part of the problem is that I think this might go back to what Brian had alluded to. A problem that was not present for me otherwise is that it feels a little dependent upon a dyed-in-the-wool Star Trek fan who knows the character of Christopher Pike.
Which I do not.
Yeah, mm-hmm. there'd be more impact there if you're familiar with him from the original TV series. But if you've only seen the Abrams movie, I mean, he's in it and he's good, but his death is...
He's like Tom Skerritt in Top Gun. Like, he's just there to say, like, you know, I knew your father and you're like him and you're going to be great, even though there's absolutely no evidence of that.
Right.
And then he dies.
Yeah. So sort of that move into sort of an attempt at narrative weight was, you know, not great.
There's another moment like that when they're about to get blasted into space dust and Kirk turns and looks at his crew, who are all wide-eyed and terrified, and he's like, I'm so sorry. And I just wanted each and every one of those people to pounce on him and to spend their last living moments ripping his flesh from his bones because everyone told him this was a stupid idea. Like, this is like if your friend is like, okay, I'm really drunk, get in the car, we're going to New York, and you're just like, you are so smashed right now. No. And then he forces you into the car, and then he drives over a bridge, and on the way down into the water, he's like, he turns to you, he's like, I am so sorry. Motherfucker, I told you this was a stupid plan. You forced me. Sorry doesn't cover it. I'm dead now because of you and your arrogance and your inability to listen.
You know, it's funny, too. That moment is played as a sort of a grand emotional beat in the trailer.
Yeah.
And sort of like that happens, and then it slides into the, again, the pretentiousness of the previews. But in the movie, he says, I'm sorry, and then the movie just kind of keeps going. They just stop to reflect on that. It sort of hints toward something meaningful, and then it goes, okay, let's keep moving.
And remember how I kept saying that the trailer just looked like a wreck, like it was just chopped up? And it's like, that is a perfect encapsulation of the movie, because it is all these moments that would work in a movie where they were earned or built to or paid off, and they're just not.
Mm-hmm.
It's like someone was like, let's just make a movie out of trailers. Here's the biggest thing, though, and this is what we'll talk about this before we sign off, because we've been talking for about an hour. He dies. Kirk dies. In the same way that Spock dies in The Wrath of Khan, which I now know... Holy crap! All right, so I started a drinking game when I was watching The Wrath of Khan. A drinking game which I had to quit 10 minutes into the movie because I realized that I would die of alcohol poisoning. And it was drink every time that something in this movie is referenced in the new Star Trek film. Mm-hmm. It's like the same story, basically, but 1,000 times more ineptly told. With no emotional payoffs, no beats. Like, I don't even watch the original Star Trek films or TV series, but The Wrath of Khan still made total sense to me. Whereas this movie was a nightmare. But so Kirk has to go in, and he has to fix a galaxy-spanning, incredibly, like, fine-tuned nuclear reactor by holding on to a bar and swinging to smash his feet into it repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
Which I can't even do to get my car to start. And so then that realigns the couplings, and then he dies of radiation poisoning. And then, oh wait, Khan has super blood. And this brings him back from the dead.
Yay!
Yay. Yeah. So that's it. And this happens like in the last 15 minutes of the movie. So, like, he dies. Okay, we got to get him back. We got him back. Hooray. Like, it's like such a... They make such a big deal about it. It becomes such a huge plot point, even though we've barely had time to register the fact that Chris Pine is dead instead of just, like, knocked out. And so Spock goes alone to foot chase a madman through an entire city because there's literally no one else on the boat who can go with him, apparently. Not only that, but they beam him down a full block behind the madman... When you have a teleporting capability that could have put him well ahead of the madman so that he could dive tackle him from the front like a linebacker. And then they're like, you have to get him alive because we need his blood. Blood doesn't evaporate when you murder someone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So like, so Spock very easily could have killed him. Spock could have done like a brutal ritualistic sacrifice where he slits his throat and then holds a chalice under it. And then catches the blood and brings it back to Kirk and then feeds it to him like Last Crusade style to bring him back from the dead. Not only that, but there's 72 other genetically engineered supermen that they could totally use the blood of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, someone pointed out that after this movie, the stakes in Star Trek are pretty much removed unless somebody is evaporated by a photon phaser.
Yeah.
Because now, if somebody dies, you just get some blood and
give him some cumber blood.
Yeah,
and everything will be fine.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
This is terrible storytelling.
it's not good storytelling now.
All right, I just wanted to get that off my chest because I was infuriated sitting there watching this with Spock and his little bobbed haircut wig flying in the wind.
Yeah,
as he foot chases
when he shouts Khan.
Oh God.
Oh yeah, that was a little bizarre.
Because that's like the most stupid pandering thing you can do, and it's not. Khan isn't even the reason that Kirk died. Fucking Peter Weller is. Peter Weller's the one who fired on the ship. Peter Weller's the reason that the coupling had to be drop-kicked back into place. So he should have been like, Weller! Or Wallace, I guess, was his name.
RoboCop!
Oh, God. I was going to say, William S. Burroughs!
So, before we go, I have to read this for you. Last night, a former guest of ours, Eric D. Snyder, sent me a message on GChat. I have to read this out, okay?
Okay, I'm down with this.
Okay. Exclusive. Here is how the first draft went. John Harrison. My name is Khan. Captain Kirk. Oh, okay. Why did you say it was John Harrison? Should we call you Khan then? It's not hard to pronounce or anything. Why did you tell us the wrong name at first? Were you worried we'd be prejudiced against people with foreign-sounding names? End scene.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, if you hear the name John Harrison and you thought that would, like, actually be the villain's name, like, I didn't know it was going to be Khan or anything, but I'm like...
You know what's weird?
If you have a movie like this, the villain can't be named John Harrison.
I was going to say that John Harrison is a much more menacing-sounding name than Khan.
Mm.
Really?
Like, just say it to yourself, like, John Harrison. Like, a terrorist named John Harrison. Like, that's... That's menacing on a deep level because it's just like, it's such a normal name. I loved the name John Harrison. I was like, wow. Like, I don't know why, but just that name attached to Benedict Cumberbatch, it's like such an unassuming name and he looks like such an unassuming person. But then you see his eyes and he opens his mouth and he becomes like this demon. And then it's like, oh, my name is actually, what? His full name is like Khan Singh.
Khan Noonien Singh.
Yeah.
Except in the movie, he's just Khan, because he's clearly not Sikh.
Well, that's... No, but the old Spock... Oh, my God, they talk to old Spock.
Oh, right. Hey. I would have liked if...
Hello, exposition department? Can I get an exposition character, please?
1-800-MR-SPOCK.
Oh, my God.
I was thinking...
He calls him
fun.
Khan Noonien Singh.
Yeah, but... He can't be... He can't be Indian.
He is, though.
That's not possible. It's literally not possible.
I know. Well, I mean, imperialism?
Mm-hmm. I would have liked if when young Spock calls old Spock and he asks him about Khan, if old Spock just goes, oh, for the love of fucking God. Or just like, what? Why is he back? That doesn't make... Just something... I felt like that... There was no surprise... With Spock Prime, as he's called, he just sort of accepted it. Like, oh he's not good.
He's not great. He's a bad guy. He says like he's the most like diabolical evil man we've ever come across. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly Spock Beta, I don't know what the hell his real name should be. Young Spock is like, I know you're a genocidal maniac. It's, where did that come from?
Because
no one used the term genocide.
I mean, he probably just inferred.
Well, if a guy's diabolical, he's probably genocidal, right?
So, this does raise a question. In this new universe, does Spock talk to his alternate?
Like, do they call? Like, is it like?
Self?
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, is it like calling your mom once a month and like you check in and?
Yeah,
like, are they friends?
Yeah, it's very confusing. Just that he's still in this universe. Like, what is he up to?
I don't know. He's hanging. You know, he's chilling. I really have no idea. It's fucking ridiculous. Okay, I'm done. I'm out of things to say. Does anyone else have anything to say?
I think the movie's fine.
I think it's terrible.
Okay.
Danny?
I probably didn't like it.
Okay.
We'll see.
Okay. All right, so let's move on. Blu-ray and DVD releases for May 21st, which, hey, is my birthday. Let's see what I can buy myself as a present. The Last Stand, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. Wow, this isn't getting off to a good start. Side Effects, which is a movie I enjoyed greatly. Beautiful Creatures, which is a movie that I did not enjoy greatly, but which wasn't as bad as it could have been. Yeah, I don't know, man. That seems like...
Oh, wow.
Sinful Nuns of St. Valentine. Mm-hmm. That's coming out. The ABCs of Death.
Parker.
Struck by Lightning, Parker.
Parker.
Parker. Richard Parker?
There's a movie.
Stand-up guys.
This is interesting. Warner Brothers are releasing two classic gangster movies, White Heat and The Public Enemy, on Blu-ray.
Nice.
So that's kind of cool.
James Cagney.
Yeah. So it's of note. There's a movie called Neighboring Sounds out on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Which is supposed to be, have you seen it?
No, but it's supposed to be great.
It's supposed to be one of the best movies of last year. So it's actually on iTunes. I'll probably rent it soon. Also, a little overshadowed releases, a movie called The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah,
which is a horror movie from the 70s. It's supposed to be really, really terrific, but it's never been released on home video. So for it to be coming out now is exciting. There's actually a remake that's in development, so it's probably better that they release this now instead of the Tuesday before the remake. Kind of maybe get it to be a little more seen, I guess.
Yeah.
But that's cool. I'd like to see that. So there's some good titles.
Yeah.
Besides, you know, I'd like to give Side Effects another shot.
Yeah, I don't know. I really want Side Effects, so I'll be buying Side Effects.
That cover for Medium Cool is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
I've never seen it either. It just kind of makes me think of Hackers. That's a reference.
Well, it's good that's your point of reference.
Well, because the hacker in that is named Zero Cool. So I feel like Medium Cool is like maybe a little bit above that.
Mm.
All right. So that's DVDs and Blu-rays. Coming to theaters May 24th.
Oh, Lord.
Fast 6. Actually, no, it's Fast and Furious 6.
Although the on-screen title is Furious 6.
Jesus, really?
Yeah.
Okay. This is the most nonsensically named movie series ever. Because first it was The Fast and the Furious. Then it was like Too Fast, Too Furious. Then it was Tokyo Drift. Then it was... Fast and Furious. Then it was Fast 5. Now it's Fast and Furious 6. When really this should be Fast and Furious 2. Because there was only one Fast and Furious before this.
Mm-hmm. Right, and also Furious 6.
Yes, but I'm looking forward to it. Because I didn't see any... Oh, I know. I saw like part of the first one and I hated it. And then I saw the fifth one. And that was a crazy, ridiculous good time. And it makes no sense. And it doesn't try to make sense. And it doesn't have any pretensions. And sometimes you just need that in your life. So we'll see where this one goes, because it looks crazy. The Hangover 3, which I'm looking forward to never seeing and not liking, and just... I liked the first Hangover.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the second Hangover was a goddamn disgrace.
Yeah.
Okay, so in Fast and Furious... Hangover Part 3, not something I'm looking forward to. Epic, which is just a very bizarre movie title, when you probably could have found something more interesting in the world created in it to name it after. That looks like it could be fun if I, you know, was 6 or had a 6-year-old to take to the movies. But the real gem coming out this weekend is Before Midnight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm actually going today to see all of the other Before films at my friend's in-house movie theater.
Oh, nice.
So I'm looking forward to doing that and then immediately being able to go see Before Midnight this coming weekend. Any other thoughts on the films coming out this weekend? Anyone that your guys are particularly looking forward to?
Yeah, I want to see Before Midnight. I don't know when I'm going to see it. Probably not this coming weekend. I might have to wait a little bit, which is fine. But
yeah,
I do want to see it.
We're not going to be reviewing it this coming weekend, but we will hopefully be reviewing it soon.
I think, yeah, hopefully. I don't even know what we're reviewing next week.
Have you seen Upstream Color yet?
I could watch it.
Okay, you want to do that?
Yeah, sure.
It's either that or Francis Ha if I can get to it.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay.
Anyway.
We do a double.
Yeah, Francis Ha.
Otherwise, no. I mean, The Hangover 3 I'll watch on HBO and hate myself for it. But,
I will hopefully watch that while drunk.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, I don't have an affection for the Fast and Furious series, so I don't care.
I feel so bad for Justin Bartha in the Hangover movies.
Oh, he's doing fine.
he's nowhere in anything, and he's constantly just being left behind. Mm-hmm. Everyone else is, like, blown up because of it, and he's just like, hi, I'm still Justin Bartha. You just canceled my TV show, so I've got a lot of free time. Anyway, Danny, what about yourself?
Yeah, pretty much the link later.
Okay. So now we'll talk about movies that we've seen on our own briefly, and then we will leave you people to your week. And yeah, let's start off with Nick, since we started with Danny on the round robin earlier.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
that means you begin.
Yes, absolutely. Watched a lot of good movies this week. Did. I think the one that I'm going to settle on is In a Lonely Place, which is a film directed by Mr. Nicholas Ray, who I had mentioned a couple of months ago, actually when we reviewed Side Effects, little looping back there. Mm-hmm. Talked about his movie Johnny Guitar. This is In a Lonely Place, starring Humphrey Bogart. It's a noir film sort of on the surface. Its narrative kind of deals with noir trappings and whatnot. But it's the approach that this movie takes to the genre that's really fascinating. I've never seen a noir film that plays with uncertainty and ambivalence and sort of your perception of an actor the way that In a Lonely Place does. This is a really, really wonderful movie. I think that, you know, sort of my perception of Nicholas Ray is a little different than what this movie had given me. Part of it is because this is in black and white, and his use of color is always so expressive and explosive and sort of kind of ensconces you in a way. This movie uses typical noir black and white in a very elegant, beautiful fashion. It's a twisty yarn. It has this really, just sort of this really amazing sense of character to it that I feel like I don't always get with the genre, to be honest. So I really love this movie. I think this is a great motion picture.
Well, a Bogart starring noir is right up my alley, so I'll have to check that out.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Danny, what about yourself?
Yeah, I also saw a few good things. I'll mention this kind of really rare film called Heart from, like, 1987. And it was cool to see on the big screen, because there's a Q&A after with the co-writer and the producer, Randy Jurgensen. He's actually the guy who he's consulted with William Friedkin quite a bit, because Jurgensen is an ex-cop. And so on films like French Connection and Cruising, him and Friedkin were pretty close, and he would kind of advise the director and stuff like that. But Heart's a pretty standard movie. It's about a boxer played by Brad Davis from Midnight Express, and it's almost like a low budget, even lower budget riff on Rocky. Like, he's just kind of down on his luck, and he gets a fight, and he tries his best. But it's a cool movie just because Jurgensen was also involved with these films like Maniac and Maniac Cop, which I mentioned a few weeks ago, and those are like B movie genre pictures, whereas Heart is almost like B movie straight drama. So it's kind of like an interesting film because it's like just so sincere and authentic, and yet with this like kind of B movie look. But yeah, it's a pretty good movie. Randy Jurgensen seemed pretty cool.
Myself, I watched a new film that came out in theaters and on VOD, and it's called Black Rock.
Oh, how was that?
It was pretty good. It's only like 80 minutes long, so I mean, like, you're not gonna commit yourself too much. The three actresses at the center of it, Kate Bosworth, Katie Asselton, and Blake Bell, are fantastic. And they're very believable as a group of old friends who are kind of working through some stuff on an island together. The story and screenplay are by Mark Duplass and Katie Asselton. Asselton? Does anyone know how to pronounce her name? No?
Not really.
All right. And actually, Katie also directs the film, and it's a beautiful film, and the acting is great. The problem is, like, this movie is about these three women who run into these three guys who are hunting on an island, and then everything kind of goes to shit, and some bad things happen, and the guys turn homicidal. And that's cool, I guess. That's, like, fine. There's some interesting subtexts with how women are treated in pop culture and, like, the kind of, like, blame the victim rape culture as well. The problem that I have is just that, like, the guys are fresh off of a tour of, like, duty in Iraq, and, like, there's some stuff made about, like, their time there, and, you know, they throw around a lot of kind of cliched military terms regarding people of Middle Eastern descent. And it's just like, I don't know, it's just a little uncomfortable that, like, we
Does it feel like it's trying too hard to
either say something or just to, like, trade on stereotypes about, like, deranged war veterans, you know? And, like, I don't know if I'm just hypersensitive to that.
No, I heard that part of the film was kind of, like, odd.
Yeah, it's, like, a little cringe-inducing, you know? Because mm-hmm. it's like there's this one guy who seems like a decent guy until he's not, and then the other two guys are kind of, like, quiet, reserved guys until they're not. And, like, the only exposition we get is, like, yeah, we went to Iraq and some bad shit happened. We were dishonorably discharged, but, you know, sometimes you got to do a thing. It's like, okay, well, that's barely character building. But, again, just for the performances of the three main actresses and for the interesting subtexts that are done and things like that, I think it's worth a look. It's, like I said, it's available on VOD. I think this is actually one of those films that's, like, perfect for VOD.
Yeah.
Like, to the wonder, not so much. This film, yes. So check it out on VOD. It's, like, $7, and it's definitely worth the time.
The people in Black Rock shall love.
Whether they like it or not. Yes. Ooh, that's not a good quote, considering what happens in this film.
Oh, okay. Whether you like it or not. Oh, God. I'm so sorry.
Jesus. Okay, so that's it for this week. Next week, we will be talking perhaps about Upstream Color or Francis Ha. I might actually go out and see Fast 6, so you can look forward to me talking about that if I do. Other than that, though, I think we've come to the end, so let's say where we can be found, and then we can get out of these people's way. Danny, start us off.
Ah, yes. Filmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And Nick?
Filmstage.com, twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And I can be found at filmstage.com, as well as twitter.com/BrianJRowan, and my personal site, dearfilm.net. So thank you once again, ladies and gentlemen, and join us next week. Film Star Trek.
Danny?
What?
We just lost Danny.
Damn you, Danny! That was an excellent intro.
Dan!
It's
supposed to be like con edit.
Yeah, I got it. I gotcha. I'm on your level.